The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this week's edition of Century, we'll hear the first part of my conversation with Dr. Tim Pionkowski, a researcher and lecturer at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. He's been doing some great work regarding harm reduction in the community of people who use image and performance-enhancing drugs. But first, the National Safer Supply Community of Practice held another in its series of research webinars on September 21st to launch its new 2023 evaluation report on the London, Ontario Intercommunity Health Centre's Safer Opioid Supply Program. Dr. Andrea Sarita is the lead and founding physician for the Safer Opioid Supply Program at the London Intercommunity Health Centre. Here's Dr. Sarita.
I'm Dr. Andrea Sarita, and I'm the clinical lead of the Safer Opioid Supply Program here at London Intercommunity Health Centre. We're really excited to share this evaluation. It really documents the impact Safer Supply has continued to have on the lives of people who use drugs in London. And we would like to acknowledge all of the people who have contributed to expanding this evidence base for Safer Supply. In particular, we acknowledge the brave work of people who use drugs as they guide us in the development of Safe Supply. And we thank all drug users who have acted as subject matter experts, who have participated in our advisory committees, and who have given us informal feedback to make prescribed Safer Supply what it is today. I think it's pretty well known. We've been operating Safe Supply here in London at the Intercommunity Health Centre since 2016. And there was a real sea change in London between 2014 and 2016 when fentanyl went from being this contaminant in the unregulated street supply to dominating the unregulated supply. And prescribed Safer Supply here at the health center, it was a response to that early devastation that was happening in London as fentanyl became the dominant product on the street. And I have been completely honest about this. In 2016, I felt completely overwhelmed with the number of people we were losing to fentanyl. More traditional addiction medicine interventions like methadone alone, they were not cutting it to meet the needs of folks at that time period. And people who were going away to things like residential abstinence-based treatment or jail or hospital were returning to our community with no opioid tolerance, and many of them died. You know, I've been a physician for 16 years now, and I have been working with people who use drugs since 2010, well before fentanyl hit the streets in London. I also worked for years as an emergency room doc. I'm used to seeing death, but what was happening on the streets of London from 2016 onwards, the number of people who were suffering and dying was shocking. For all the people who use drugs in the audience today, I was seeing my patients die. But for people who use drugs, these are your community members, your friends, and your family. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge everyone we have lost to this toxic drug crisis. In recognition of the almost 40,000 dead across Canada, I would encourage you, if you're comfortable, to share a name or an initial of someone you have lost in blood. So it's people who use drugs, and probably some of the names that are appearing in the chat right now, who push Safer Supply forward. We hear all the time about meeting people where they're at in harm reduction. And as you contemplate what we're going to discuss in this presentation, I want you to remember that meeting people where they're at doesn't just mean putting on a backpack and going to an encampment. It really means centering the voices of the people you're serving, treating people as experts in their own lives, meeting them in their own cultural and social contexts, and treating them as colleagues and equals. It means recognizing that poverty, colonialism, classism, capitalism, structural violence, they are all the foundation of the fentanyl crisis we find ourselves in today. And Safe Supply prescribers, we stand on the shoulders of brave drug user activists who have pioneered harm reduction across this country. And again, another reflection point, I would like to pause and think about the fact that everything we currently take for granted in harm reduction, it was once illegal. And drug users have borne the burden not just of surviving decades of stigma and marginalization, but they've had to take on the enormous and brave job of creating and implementing life-saving solutions. Needle exchanges were illegal in the 1980s when people were trying to save their friends from HIV. Safe injection sites are becoming more common in Canada, but before InSite, drug users risked their own legal freedoms by operating underground safe injection sites to save the lives of their peers. and naloxone's in every street corner in Canada these days. But, you know, before that, harm reduction activists had to beg and borrow naloxone for a decade before the government provided it. And safe supply has been on the lips of almost all drug user activists for years before our team discovered what it was. And so just like every other harm reduction intervention that people who use drugs have come to us with, they also knew what the antidote to fentanyl might be before doctors like myself had a clue. And acknowledging as well that safe supply is about so much more than drugs. It's about building relationships with people who have been pushed to the margins. And it's about ensuring medical professionals provide comprehensive care to people who use drugs. CAPUD is the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs. And they have put out a policy document in 2019 that defines safer supply. CAPUD says, safer supply refers to the legal and regulated supply of drugs with mind and body altering properties that traditionally have been accessible only through the illicit market. And prescribed safer supply builds upon what we learn from CAPUD, and prescribed safer supply now exists within this growing and robust evidence base, and Dr. Kola will be reviewing our most recent contributions to this evidence. And I'm really happy that we're now in the position to share more evidence about the impact safer supply is having on communities, people who use drugs. Before we do that, I think it's important that we acknowledge that in the past 6 months, we have seen safe supply attacked by those who wish to eliminate harm reduction generally across Canada. Research like the research we're going to show with you today is being attacked for incorporating the voices of people who use drugs. Critics in the media, some politicians are intent on devaluing and dismissing what people who use drugs tell us about their experiences on safe supply. And this really, it acts to dehumanize people who use drugs, because the narratives being created is that people who use drugs will lie about their experiences on the program. And the narrative that drug users lie, compulsively lie, it paves the way for things like forced treatment, because we no longer have to listen to the voices of people with lived experience. We have seen safe supply be turned into a political wedge issue and used to inflame stigma and violence against people who use drugs. And the attempted rebranding of safe supply to public supply of addictive drugs, or PSAD, this terminology functions to reassert the pathologization of substance use and reaffirm the centrality of carceral models that are focused on surveillance and strict control of drug users. We are seeing some provinces move towards a lock-em-up approach to people who use drugs. We see statements about do no harm. But do no harm, it neglects the harms of doing nothing. There is real harm in doing nothing or continuing to do the same old thing that is not meeting people's needs anymore while tens of thousands of people die. We are hearing so many negative anecdotes about safe supply in the media, but it's not what people who use drugs tell us. Let us, you know, recenter the voices of people who are in the middle of this toxic drug crisis. Recenter the voices of people who use drugs. Let us recenter the fact that this is an emergency and that every harm reduction program, not just safe supply, that is attacked or closed means that more people will die. I want us to recenter working together to save lives, because we need all hands on deck right now. We need safe supply. We need an expansion in access to methadone and buprenorphine. We need residential treatment beds for people who have been on waiting lists for months and months. We need the continuation of services like safe injection spaces. We need this wide spectrum of options. Harm reduction and treatment should not be enemies. They should be collaborative partners. And so let none of us here give into the temptation of partisanship or siloing of approaches or this binary mindset that says harm reduction and treatment cannot coexist.
That was Dr. Andrea Sarita, the lead and founding physician for the Safer Opioid Supply Program at the London, Ontario Intercommunity Health Centre, speaking at the launch of the 2023 evaluation report on LIHC's Safer Opioid Supply Program. Find out more at the website nss-aps.ca. That's nss-aps.ca. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I have been working on drug policies and issues involving substance use for almost 40 years now. And, you know, I know a little bit about a lot of stuff, but I know nothing about performance and image-enhancing drugs. Well, almost nothing. I've been reading up on the topic lately, and I really should have started doing that 20 years or more ago. I have a lot to learn. And that brings me to my guest, Dr. Timothy Pionkowski. Tell me about yourself, the work you do. Who are you?
So, hi, I'm Tim. I'm a researcher and a lecturer at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. And my, I guess the focus of my research is harm reduction. And it's harm reduction specifically around people who use illicit substances, and to drill down even further, those who use image and performance enhancing drugs. So what most people think is anabolic steroids, but is actually quite a bit deeper, broader than just steroids.
So, expand on that. What are these things? Like I say, as you said, when I hear image is the first question, huh? But when I hear about performance enhancing drugs, my first thought is steroids, and that had always been the last thought. I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one. So what are these things?
So we'll start with the most well-known category, and that's anabolic steroids. So things like testosterone, but other derivatives of testosterone as well. So DHT derivatives like drostanolone, 19-nor derivatives like nandrolone and trenbolone. And those are all injectable, by the way. And you've got oral compounds as well. So things like turinabol, things like anadrol, and I'm mixing together some brand names and some actual names, but just to give you an idea, I guess, of what they're called colloquially as well as in the literature. So I guess generally what iPad consumers will do is stack certain drugs. So you might start off with just using testosterone enanthate. So an oil that you inject, you know, once a week, twice a week, you might do that for about 10 weeks and then stop and then enter what's called a post-cycle therapy phase. So you might take some other drugs then to rebalance your hormones, also wash off some of that systemic stress that you've caused from the drugs. So you might use something like tamoxifen or clomiphene or HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, to restart your system. And then generally, if you've spent 10 to 12 weeks on testosterone, you will spend 10 to 12 weeks off. And that comprehensively would encompass your first steroid cycle or something like that, or your first iPad cycle. Now, what tends to happen more commonly now is people opt to blast and cruise. So they will use a little bit of testosterone each week for year round, and around competition or around specific times, they might throw in another compound or two. They might increase the dose of their testosterone, might add in oral derivatives, and so on and so forth. And therefore, they won't do this restarting process. They'll try and keep the systemic stress low. And then when they're ready to, or they're just done with competing, they might step away from that entirely and then choose to restart and go through that process. So I guess that's sort of the first point I want to make. There's the staples in the drug diet and the way they're used. Now, generally, I mean, that just captures the sort of stock standard male iPad user. Women, females will generally opt for slightly different sort of courses and compounds. They might use oxandrolone, so Anavar, and they might start off with that for a number of weeks around whatever sort of goal they have. And I'll speak to that more later. Alongside these sort of staples, as we'll call them, there's other substances or other iPads that people will use. So things like thermogenics, so clenbuterol or dinitrophenol, to increase body temperature and increase heart rate and try and get rid of some of that fat, so get leaner. You might also use insulin, so a very anabolic hormone, shuttles a lot of carbohydrates and protein and other micronutrients into the tissue. So people might choose to use that, might also choose to use growth hormone. So human growth hormone, increase fat loss as well as muscle mass retention and gain, or any combination of these things. Other things like prohormones, so Superdrol, peptides, there's a big long list. Some people specifically just use tanning products like melanotan 2 to change the color of their skin to be more tanned rather than or get a bit more bang for their buck out of sun tanning. And there's other benefits or other effects that come from those drugs as well. So I think that's the sort of broad picture that we can paint there.
It is a lot more complicated. And well, you mentioned competition and there too. I'm familiar with some of the people who've been, professional baseball players, some of the other professional athletes, back in 2003, I was diagnosed with testicular cancer, went through that treatment, and at that time, Lance Armstrong was a real hero and inspiration, and that changed. So you got people like, the renowned cheat. But it's not just, people like, who uses these things? And who's using these things and why?
So it's really shifted, and that dynamic's changed and been noted in the literature since before the turn of the decade, the millennium. Sorry, in that it's not just athletes or high level athletes that are using these things to use the term cheat in tested competitions. It's not just people doing that. It's people going to the gym. People, balancing the struggles or the challenges of parenthood and wanting to still have a good body. Or in Australia, we'd say a good rig. And people that are just for well-being, general well-being. You've got men in their 40s, testosterone levels start to dip, might throw on a patch, throw on some gel, inject half a mil of Sustanon a week or anything like that. There's generally other effects that people are seeking outside of just performance. But a lot of people do, turn to these for the image enhancing effects. They want to get bigger. They want to get leaner. They want to look good when they go to the beach. Or they want to succeed in their competition, whether that's an untested competition. So like a lot of powerlifting competitions or strongman, strongwoman, bodybuilding, certain federations, or other sports. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, for example, ADCC, they don't have testing procedures there. And there's other sports as well. So variety, huge variety of reasons, Doug, that really depend on the individual.
Now, I want to ask about some of the other health-related effects about mental health and behavior. We've all heard about the anger issues related to use of steroids. And as I was composing this question, I realized that I am guilty now of way oversimplifying things and missing the point that you were just making. I mean, we're not talking about just a single drug. This is a group of different drugs, and there are different effects. And then, of course, this is the illegal market in these drugs, so there's going to be some novel chemicals that are entering the mix. It's kind of inevitable. So with all that in mind, talk to me about some of the health effects. I mean, are some of these drugs riskier than others? And does the way we try to regulate and control make some of these health effects more or less of a concern?
Excellent question. So I'll answer this in a sort of three phases. One, definitely we have documented health effects that come from these substances, iPeds and then steroids specifically. So we know that there is a chance of cardiovascular effects. There is a chance of stroke or a high propensity for stroke. There is a high propensity for, because of the blood pressure increases predominantly. There is, so those are sort of the predominant physical, physiological characteristics. Now, for the other organs in the body, so liver, kidneys, there's a lot more strain, particularly from oral derivatives. So taking the tablets, a lot of them have to pass through the liver twice, and I'm oversimplifying here, but puts more strain, and therefore, you know, I've had participants previously who, yeah, have had a rupture or have had an issue because of these things. Same with the kidneys. Filtration rate can decrease over time, and therefore, when I speak about systemic strain, that's sort of what I'm referring to. And I mean, from my research, participants are the more experienced participants, particularly, they're aware. They know that they might be, you know, taking a bit of a risk, but there's a message coming out there now. And I mean, I'm one of the people that's pushing that message that we have, you know, understanding that this isn't, none of it is safe, but it can be, harms can be mitigated, harms can be managed. And I guess I just want to introduce one idea of an argument there, in that if we might be shaving a few years off people's life, yes, might be doing that, but for quality of life, some people are willing to make that trade-off. They're willing to, you know, for using a little bit of testosterone, for example, increasing their bone mass, increasing muscle mass, having a little bit of a higher quality. So decreased risk of falls, perhaps, because everything's a little bit stronger and more structurally sound. Although, yes, perhaps the heart takes a little bit more strain in some instances, and there's some, you know, nuances there. That's sort of the first point I wanted to raise. Yes. Now, there are some psychological effects, and you know, everybody speaks about roid rage, and that sort of comes out. Now, some of my more recent work, particularly last year, this year, and ongoing, really points towards one compound being responsible for a lot of the psychological effects among people, and that's trenbolone, the 19-nor derivative. It's originally used in heifers to assist in maintaining or increasing muscle mass. It's delivered as a pellet called Finoplex, also available in an implant, and used, we're talking for, you know, a cow. I think the top that I've seen in the literature was about 90 milligrams of trenbolone, and yeah, a week, something like that. I'd have to have another look. So we've got, and we've had consumers using these substances at in excess of, you know, 400, 600, 800 milligrams per week. And, you know, some of them might be getting close to the size of a cow, but it's still a little way off. And I don't think it was interrogated in the medical or in the literature effectively previously, partly because when I began moving down this road and I sort of stepped into the field, I guess, I think there was an underrepresentation of the voices of iPad consumers. And therefore, we missed out on this organic sort of interplay between harm reduction and drug policy that could occur. The fact that consumers literally said, this is what's causing the harm. This is what's causing the psychosocial harm. And so I picked up on that and have sort of gone down this route of running a bit of a survey, a large international survey looking at aggression, psychological distress, and trenbolone use between current users, lifetime trenbolone users, and non-trenbolone users. So be interesting to see how that plays out. That's ongoing, as well as some more interviews specifically with those who use trenbolone. And preliminary data would suggest that there's a certain range of milligrams a week that tend not to come with such heavy psychosocial effects. And there's a certain point where some people do experience those. But a lot of consumers speak about the fact that it's, you know, this interplay between the drugs and the person. The drugs and the person make a difference in that people that weren't necessarily inclined to be violent wouldn't be violent after the, you know, deploying trenbolone, for example. I think, you know, there's certainly instances where I've seen in the literature and heard from people where that has happened. But obviously, it's why we do research. So I think for psychological effects, I think trenbolone has actually been the culprit for masking this roid rage phenomenon for a while. There's other drugs that powerlifters or athletes will specifically use for driving aggression, things like Anadrol or halotestin, so floxymethylene. But there seems to be an ability there to drive that aggression into the bar, into the sport, into the what they're doing as well. So there's a lot of factors at play here. So I think that's the second part of that question that I want to answer. Third part, the structural components that you spoke of and how that makes a difference. So the illegality, right? So I've got a bit of work that's coming out on this soon, and it actually kept coming up organically in participant interviews. So when we spoke about the challenges associated with iPad use and what that meant, particularly for Australians here in Queensland, steroids are a Schedule 1 substance. So like heroin, like methamphetamine. I know in US you operate on a similar system where it's...
Actually, we're a Schedule 3, so prescription use, but restricted, obviously.
Yeah. But there's still a chance of jail. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So here, you know, get caught with steroids and the threat is 25 years in prison being the maximum time. So that in itself seems to cause, I've not heard of somebody spending 25 years in prison for one vial of testosterone. There's some nuances there in the court, but that's the suggestion. Now, a lot of consumers have said, this makes it challenging for me. I don't feel like I'm doing anything wrong. I am using this for my bodybuilding competition. I'm using this for XYZ. That said, because it is an illegal behavior, it does get wrapped up in and with other illegal behaviors, so other criminal activity. And therefore, there have been instances where participants have recounted events where, you know, they did get caught with steroids and then they had to go to court, and that sort of caused some other issues in their life. And then suddenly, you know, they're hanging around with other people involved in, you know, these antisocial behaviors, if you want to call them that. And then, you know, things continue down that trajectory. So are there structural issues? Yes, there are. Are they the same as other substances that we talk about, other illicit substances? I'd argue, yeah, there's definitely parallels there.
That was part one of my conversation with Dr. Tim Piotrkowski, a researcher and lecturer at Griffith University. We'll have part two on next week's show. For now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.